This is a recording from the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more at cvillepodcast.com. Virginia is home to 8 Indian tribes, 6 of whom are seeking federal recognition so they can have more self-governance and self-reliance. On January 19, 2008, Chief Kenneth Adams of the Upper Mattapony updated a crowd assembled at the monthly breakfast of the Charlottesville and Albemarle County Democrats on the status of pending legislation to grant federal status to the 6 tribes. Adams was the first Indian in Virginia to graduate from a public high school.
Basically, I'm going to talk about federal recognition. But in order to talk about it in a modern sense, I have to go back and explain to how we got to this point a little bit. Exactly how we got to this point of why federal recognition is so important. There was a doctrine that was established in the 1400s. There was a doctrine that was established by, actually was established by the Pope around 1452. And that was what is referred to as the doctrine of discovery. Most people are not taught the doctrine of discovery in the school system unless they study law. If they study law, perhaps they've studied the doctrine of discovery. But the great majority of people don't have a clue what the doctrine of discovery is. Well, going back to the 1450s, Portugal was involved in the slave trade in a big way. The Pope liked that. And the reason he liked that was because he felt it was a way to propagate Christianity. Now, as a Christian myself, I find that a bit offensive that took place. But that was his way of propagating Christianity, because his doctrine was basically that any place that a European Christian nation set down a flag or chose to go to, then as Christians they had a God-given right to capture those people and enslave them, take their lands and possessions in the conversion process to Christianity. So basically they had free rein as long as they were in some sort of mode of conversion. And if you look at the way the northern continent is laid out, I mean, North and South America, the American continent, how this continent is laid out, it's sort of divided up with different language speakers, because the Spanish are in South America for the most part, the Spanish-speaking people. The English-speaking people are in North America. And then there's sort of like a mingling right there at the borders of all of the different speakers. But so when the British came here and planted the flag down in 1607, they claimed Virginia as English territory. As far as they were concerned, the Indians that lived here, or the indigenous people that lived here, had absolutely no right to own this property. It was theirs, because they were a Christian nation and they were able to plant that flag here and so claimed it. As a matter of fact, it's my understanding when they actually planted the cross on the James River, it wasn't Christ on the cross, it was King James. So there's a lot of history there, but the doctrine of discovery that was perpetuated beginning in the 1450s, continued until this day. I'm not sure if you've heard about the attempt by the Russians to plant a flag on the ocean floor under the Arctic Circle. Why would they choose to do that? Because if they planted that flag on the ocean floor and claimed it according to the doctrine of discovery, it was theirs. It was theirs. Now, if you look at the way the United States was populated by Europeans, the French were in the center part of the, up through the Mississippi River Valley and westward, and the French had claimed that land. Everybody's heard of the Louisiana Purchase. The French claimed that land for France. England had claimed everything east of the Mississippi River, basically. And, of course, the Spanish claimed parts of Texas and New Mexico, California, and Arizona. Well, when the Louisiana Purchase took place, Jefferson did not purchase the land from the Indians. He purchased it from France. So according to Jefferson, he was supporting the doctrine of discovery also, because his thought was that the Indians had no claim to that land, even though they had occupied it for over 10,000 years. They had absolutely no claim to it. That same claim of this doctrine of discovery was perpetuated by the United States government in 1823 when John Marshall ruled that the Indians, the indigenous people that occupied the land, only had the right to occupy it. They did not have the right to own it. And even though John Marshall was stating that in support of the doctrine, in his writings and musings, he knew that he was morally wrong. He knew that he was morally wrong to say the Indians had no claim to that land at all. So in the process, even though they had no claim to the land, for some reason, France and Spain and England continued to sign treaties with the various Indian nations. They continued to sign treaties. Of course, I would say that 99% of those treaties were broken, if not more. Now, I think every single one of them was broken in some fashion or another. Every single treaty that the United States signed with the Indians. And in this past year, there was a resolution before the United Nations, and that resolution was to provide some rights, some human rights to indigenous people. There were only three countries that voted against the resolution: the United States, Australia, and Canada. All English-speaking nations, all with a large indigenous population. So I'm not sure what that says, why those three nations voted against it. I'm really not sure what it says, but it does say something, I'm sure. Why they were the only three out of over 100 nations that were looking at this resolution. That all being said, I have to go back to this treaty situation. In 1781, the United States was formed. I think I have my date right. In 1776, of course, there was the Declaration of Independence. 1781, the war was over, and the United States was officially the United States of America. In 1790, there was some rulings that came out of the United States government in dealing with the Indian tribes. By that time, however, the Virginia Indians were so decimated that they had little strength to stand up for anything. The population had decreased from about 14,000 to 15,000 in 1607 to less than 90% of that. Maybe around 1,000 to 1,200 still existed in 1700. So the population was almost totally gone. They were in very small pockets of very small communities where they stayed until this very day. Some of these same communities that existed at the formation of the United States government is still in existence today. But those treaties that we had with England when the United States became a nation, the United States should have been obligated to maintain those treaties. However, when it came to the Virginia Indians, the folks had no education, had no way to deal with the United States government, so they didn't know exactly what to do, and so they just stayed in those communities that they'd been in for many, many years. And then the United States started signing treaties with other tribes. And today, because of those treaties that were signed with other tribes, there are over 560 Indian tribes, Indian nations, that have specific relationships with the United States government. Almost half of those are in Alaska, but down in the lower 48, there are close to 300 Indian tribes that have specific relationships with the United States government, written relationships. The Virginia Indians do not have that relationship. So why do we desire that relationship? The tribes in Virginia are small. There, we have no representation on the Virginia General Assembly. There's not one Virginia Indian that's represented in the Virginia General Assembly. So we don't have any much of a say so there. The County Board of Supervisors, I think we have had three representatives on different boards of supervisors over the last 20 years or so, but at this point, there's no representatives there. There are no appointed judges from the Virginia Indian tribes. So we don't have much of a say-so in the affairs and way that things come before us. I'll give you an example. That was a bill that I have, a copy of a bill that I have in this notepad here about education for Virginia Indians that was sponsored by some folks in the General Assembly. I didn't even know there was a bill being sponsored. I'm a chief of a Virginia tribe, and they don't even tell me that they're sponsoring a bill that affects education on Virginia Indians. I had not a clue. So it's a continuation of what was going on back in the 1700s and 1800s. We had so few people that they didn't pay attention to us, and now they're still not paying attention to us. So we don't have a say-so. We don't have much of a say-so. If we achieved federal recognition, we would have a direct one-on-one relationship with the federal government. We could go directly to the federal government and petition the federal government. We wouldn't have to be so much concerned about this lack of representation in the state, because our representation then would be at the highest law of the land, the United States government. So that's a major reason why we're seeking it. Now, if you go to those other 562 tribes that have recognition, we also feel that it would put us on an equal playing field with all of the other tribes in the nation. At this point, we're second-class citizens, and we're also second-class Indians because we don't have that relationship. And that does present a problem when we go to these national Indian organizations. When we're at the table, we can talk. Yes, we can be there and we can be heard. But we don't have much representation because we don't have that same level playing field. It's a different field. So what happened and why we've gotten to this point? I've given you the idea, given you a brief overview. I could go on for hours on this doctrine of discovery and how it affected so many people in the world. There's only one other thing I want to say about the 1400s, 1500s, in that time frame. Prior to the British coming, of the largest cities in the world, of the 10 largest cities in the world, there were at least two in America. At least two of the 10 largest cities in the world were in America. One of them happened to be at Poverty Point in Louisiana. There was another one on the banks of the Mississippi River in Illinois. Two of the largest cities in the world were in America. Now, if you come forward to that, to 1900, and look at the census of Indians in America, it was 250,000. Going from the largest cities in the world to 250,000 people in such a short time span in the history of the world. Reality is, that 90% of the indigenous people of North and South America were gone within 400 years of Columbus Day, 1492. Gone. Wiped from the face of the earth. Never to return, in many cases, because many of those tribes were totally, totally destroyed. Sad story from my viewpoint, and it should be a sad story for all Americans, and it should be something that's taught in the history books, but it's not. It's not taught in the history books. Recognition has come with a serious cost to us. We've been working on this bill in Congress for 8 years now. Al told you that it takes a generation or more to get it through the Bureau of Indian Affairs in an administrative route. Some tribes have been in the process through the Bureau of Indian Affairs for over 30 years. For the simple process to get an acknowledgement from the federal government that, yes, you do exist as an Indian tribe, and yes, we're going to establish this relationship with you. Sometimes it's taken over 30 years. We've been in the process for 8 years, and every year we have to go about raising money to support that cause. It's very difficult to raise the money, and it's very difficult to continue to go to Washington and face these same people over and over and over again. And until recently, Senator Warner actually was one of our strongest supporters. And a couple years ago, he started changing his tone of voice when dealing with us, and he started talking about casinos. We can't allow it for casinos in the state of Virginia. Well, we never had any intention to have casinos in Virginia. And actually, if you look at the bill, the bill doesn't allow us to have casinos in Virginia. Now, that in itself is a sort of patronism, because if you're going to recognize a tribe with certain rights for that tribe, the tribe should decide what it's going to do. It shouldn't be up to someone in Washington to decide directly what you're going to do. Nevertheless, we've written it into the bill that we are not going to even come close to casinos. It's there, black and white. Everybody can see it. But even so, Senator Warner has still not come back to our side. In November, Senator Webb came out in very strongly in support of our bill. It was less than 2 weeks ago that I saw him, and he said that he was speaking with Senator Dorgan, who is the chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee. Both Senator Webb and Senator Dorgan are Democrats, so they have, you know, they're part of the same party, so there should be some communication going on. But I'm not sure at this point why Senator Dorgan is not going forward with the request Senator Webb has placed on him. He asked Senator Dorgan to proceed with this bill and the Indian Affairs Committee. I'm not sure why Senator Dorgan hasn't done it. Now, I do believe that if both Virginia senators were in strong support of the bill, then I believe it would go forward. There's more leverage when both senators from the state are in support. So our goal this year is to proceed as much as possible with Senator Webb, try encourage him when we see him to push forward and continue to push. I think there's another thing that we have not done. There's something else that we haven't pursued, which I've been considering for a few days now, is going directly to Senator Dorgan and asking him, why are you not pushing this forward? I'd rather not do that. I'd rather Senator Webb did it. But I don't think at this point it's going to harm us to do that. And I think this year, because there's only 1 year left in the 110th Congress, that it's very important that we press with every single effort we can, no matter where it is and how it goes forward. We have to press forward as hard as we can this year, because next year there's the 111th Congress. The bill has to be reintroduced, come back through the House of Representatives again, and go back through the Senate again. So I would hopefully get Senator Dorgan, who's the chairman of the committee, to push forward with this bill. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the spiritual aspects of being a Native American. And we all have our own different religious backgrounds, different faith backgrounds. I happen to be a Christian. But I want to talk a little bit about that, because some of the stories are so profound that they're really amazing. In the context of the different faiths butting heads, one of the stories, I'm not sure if anybody's heard much about the Battle of Sand Creek. You may have heard it mentioned, but you probably haven't studied it, because it's not in the history books. The battles that were that portrayed the United States in a negative way are not in the history books so much. But this was one in particular that was very, very, it was very, very troubling if you study it. That was the Cheyenne Indians, the Arapaho Indians. They were, and I'm not sure. I think Sand Creek was in Colorado, but they had been struggling for a long time against the United States Army, trying to perpetuate their own destination rather than their destination being forced, a specific destination being forced upon them. So this particular group had finally come to the realization that they could not fight any longer. They were starving. They were down to the basic means of life, and they were struggling in a major way. So they decided to surrender, and they were not far from a United States fort. So one day, this guy, I think his name was Colonel Shivington, decided that he was going to round them up. Well, they went out and killed off most of the people that were surrendering. What is so amazing, though, not so much that they killed them off, was because in the camp, there was a United States flag. There was a United States flag flying, and there was a flag of truce flying. Yet, they went into that camp and destroyed almost everyone at the Battle of Sand Creek. And the reason I mention in the spirit of faiths butting heads is because Colonel Shivington was a minister. That's a sad story. That's a sad, sad story. Battle of Sand Creek. Battle of Sand Creek. It is said that Chief Black Kettle, the next morning when he saw the devastation, with most of his people gone, women and children included, that he said, "The circle is broken. The circle is broken." I'm not sure if you could probably grasp the significance of circle if you think of circle in a life form. in order for the people to continue to survive, there have to be people coming in and people moving on. People coming in as old folks, as infants, and the older folks moving on to another life. He said the circle is broken. Now, for him and that group of people, it was broken because all of the women and children were gone. You cannot perpetuate the people if all of the women and children are gone and only the men are left. But that was not an uncommon thing, even though that is one of the most particular incidents. It wasn't an uncommon thing because it began in Virginia. That type of activity began in Virginia. Virginia has been critical to everything that's happened in America. The first few several presidents came from Virginia. George Washington in particular. The first colony was in Virginia. So in many cases, all the positive things that America offers today began in Virginia. But some of the negative things also began in Virginia. The first reservations where Indians were placed on reservations began in Virginia. The first tribes were annihilated in Virginia. Yet, with all of the firsts that Virginia has had in a positive way, it still hasn't properly recognized the indigenous people in the land. I said the first reservations were in Virginia. There are two in Virginia, the Mattapony and Pamunkey in King William County. They've been there since the 1650s, 350 years or more. Just let's think about that for just a moment, though. Let's think about the word reservation and what it really means. You have game preserves. You have game reserves. Reservations are places where people can live, hopefully without too much outside influence. But they have been, the space that they have been provided to live on is very limited compared to the space that they lived on before. So the majority of their land base is gone. It's very difficult in some cases to raise crops because there's not enough land to do that. There's not enough land to practice the hunting that was traditional. So this reservation system, which started in Virginia, is a pretty sad thing. One of the reasons it's sad is because, going back to that doctrine of discovery again, the Indians have the right to occupy the land, but they don't have the right to own it. The land is held in trust by the United States government. How does that play out in an everyday person's life? If I lived on a reservation and I decided that I wanted to build a house on that reservation, there's absolutely no way that I could get a mortgage, because the mortgage company, if the mortgagee defaults, if he defaults on the payment, the mortgage company has no way to claim the house. It's real estate. A house and the land with it is real estate, so the mortgage company cannot claim it. So they will never offer a mortgage to someone who lives on a reservation. That has led to this tremendous amount of poverty on Indian reservations across the land. And the reality is, whether Uncle Sam chooses to believe it or not, is the only way that a great majority of those tribes have been able to lift themselves out of that poverty is through casinos. And every time we go to Washington and talk, this casino issue is thrown up in our face. I remember telling one of those people who was talking about casinos, I said, you know, we did not bring that crap here. You brought it here. Now we got to deal with it. Why don't you deal with it? Outlaw them all the way across the board, and we'll never have to worry about casinos. Don't throw it onto our backs. It's a catch-22. This casino system that some tribes have used for survival is now used against the other tribes that want certain things in their lives, which is so ironic, since we didn't bring those things to the soil. I'd like for one of those guys to go back to 1700 and see if he could find a casino. I don't think he'd let it.
Yes. Could you tell us a little bit about the tribes and what you do want?
Well, this federal recognition says that we have a right to petition, go directly to the federal government. We don't have to go these roundabout ways. We go directly as a government to government body. This government of this tribe going directly to the federal government, one-on-one relationship. Well, you know, that's such a difficult question. But one of the things that we would like to do is establish businesses within the tribal communities so we are more self-sustaining as a tribal people. I think that's a major goal. Once this acknowledgement process has gone through, it sort of lifts a burden off of everybody that's in the tribe. It's hard for me to explain it. It's more of an internal thing, because it sort of relieves you of a situation that you've been in for probably 300 years, the tribe itself, with no one to talk to, no one at the state level or the federal government level to talk to recognize the issues that the tribe has to go through. You know, one of the things that we did, Al said that I was the first Indian to graduate from high school in King William County. You know, that of course that would not happen today. But if we had federal recognition, it could never happen again, because we would be self-sustaining and have our own educational system. We could be more self-sustaining. And every person wants to have the freedom to choose their own destiny and the destiny of the people that they were born into. You cannot come into the Mattaponi tribe, the Upper Mattaponi tribe, or any tribe. You cannot just decide, I want to be a member of this tribe. People can decide they want to be a United States citizen. You cannot decide that you want to just come into the Upper Mattaponi and be a citizen of that tribe. The only way is through birth. The only way is through birth. I was born an Upper Mattaponi Indian. I was born an Upper Mattaponi Indian. I will always be one. So, as the chief and the leader of the Upper Mattaponi people, these 600 people, which are so small in number, just a minute number of people, there's more than 600 people within a mile of here, a half mile of here. Just those few people that would like to make some decisions that affect the destiny of the tribe as a whole, without outside interference. Now, when I say without outside interference, the Indians are still United States citizens. As a matter of fact, if you look at all of the wars of the 20th century, per capita, Indians have served in those wars more than any other ethnic group. Why? You ask why when we've had so much difficulty. I say the why goes back for 10,000 years, because we've lived here for so long. We've lived here for so long.
You don't have reservations in Virginia, do you?
There are two. But they're what they call state reservations. Most of the reservations are tribal reservations. Now, basically, they're still the same. I mean, they're treated basically the same. One is had to dealing with the state, and the other one, most reservations have a specific dealing with the federal government. It's a difficult situation because, and the Indians on reservations are in a serious catch 22, because they can't bring businesses onto the reservation in many ways because of the mortgage system and the default system. The business, if it folds, it can't even claim its own buildings. So that's a difficulty. And if they leave to go elsewhere and live elsewhere, they leave their entire culture and tribe behind. Now, that might not seem far-fetched to you, but if you were on the Pine Ridge Reservation and you had spent your entire life on the Pine Ridge Reservation in that community, and you left to go to Washington, D.C., in actuality, you're leaving your country. In a way, because that's all they've known all their life. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about the difference? I mean, you do have state recognition, and what does that mean versus federal? And the other thing is, I was hoping you might mention the book, The Virginia Indian Heritage.
Okay. Let me mention the book about the Heritage Program first. This is a brand new program that it was with an association with the Virginia Foundation of Humanities. It's a book that's published to provide, and this program is working to provide the public with more information about Indians because the textbooks are so sparse. It seems like according to the textbooks, we all disappeared in 1700. And you got this one century of information where Jamestown and Virginia was going on, but after that, it's like, they disappeared. They don't live here anymore. Where did they go? You know, we're still here, but there's no information to provide to the general public. As far as the state recognition for federal recognition versus federal recognition, even though we have a relationship with the state as a state recognized tribe, I'd still like to be on that same playing field as these other 500 tribes plus. I'd still love to be on that same playing field. America is all about equality, and I'd like to be on the same field that they're on. Okay. Well, it doesn't do a whole lot.
Right.
Pardon? I pay taxes. Yes, I pay taxes. There is an organization called the Virginia Council on Indians. I'm one of the people that serve on that organization at this time. And it's a government agency. In reality, I don't like serving on it, but I'm on it. Every other year, we produce a document that we present to the government and said, these are some of the things that we would like to see done for the Native communities. We have to go back with the same document 2 years later that we put forth 2 years. You know, so there's absolutely hardly anything ever done with the document. One of the good things that came out of it was the Virginia Foundation of Humanities, that we did receive a grant to work with that to actually put forth some historical material, such as, you know, there's the Civil War Trail. We have the Virginia Indian Trail. So those are funded by the state in some ways. But as far as anything else, I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any.
I might be a little confused. Finally, I'm a little familiar with the
Navajo reservation out in Arizona. So it's obviously very different. And I know that there they have their own businesses and their own schools and everything like that. And I'm assuming that the difference between being state recognized, which is just like you get the land, as opposed to being federally recognized, which you have your own schools and your own businesses. Where does the money come from for that, and how much space do you have right now?
Well, at this point, I don't think there would be an effort for anyone to have their own schools. When I was a kid in King William County that I grew up, there were three separate school systems. There was the white schools, the African American schools, and the Indian schools. I attended an Indian school for the first 10 years of school. We had 35 kids in that school. Now, that was supported in part by the county. But even that, all the books and materials were secondhand. It was obvious because when you got the fifth grade books and you started looking at them, you see where many other people had used them before. So they were really torn and tattered. They, you know, people's names in the books, the people had used them before. In the large reservations such as the Navajo, the healthcare system, is set up by the United States government. Now, why is that so? Because of the treaties and because of the relationships, the United States government has obligated itself to support those. Why did it obligate itself to support those? Because it took their land. So they naturally couldn't support themselves in many ways. So the United States says, okay, we're going to take your land, but yet at the same time, we're going to support you with our healthcare system and a school system and other things. So the money comes through a pot through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Now, if you look at on the web, as of today, and look up the Indian Health Service, the funds for the Indian Health Service for this year haven't been allocated. Now, I could go on and on about that too, because if you look at the Indian tribes and the health system that they have to deal with, the health of the Native American people is the worst of any ethnic group in the land. They're extremely unhealthy, extremely. Their life expectancy is way down compared to other people. So the health service that the government is providing somehow is failing.
Sorry.
You're still more of a U.S. citizen kind of thing. Whereas if you're federally recognized, you're completely separate, and there's no U.S. jurisdiction there. I don't understand state recognized.
Okay. The state recognized tribes have a similar relationship with the state government as the federal tribes have with the federal government. The difference is the state government in the state of Virginia has not set up a health care system, has not set up a school.
You don't have an Indian hospital.
No,
you have to go through the U.S. health
care system. Yeah, a regular health care system, because there is none.
Got it.
And it's okay now, but 50 years ago was pathetic.
Great, let me just stop just for a minute. Thank you, Ken. We'll have some questions. We're going to get out of here at 11 o'clock, so that's the way the deal works. But I wanted to take my position of being a moderator, where the heck I am, and suggest a way to look at this issue. For the most of us in this room, our ancestors came as individuals, either voluntarily or involuntarily. We came to get away from whatever it was, or were forced away from whatever it was we left in the old world. And we became part of the nation that is the United States. The Indians, however, were here. They were nations. They didn't ask to be broken up and split up and have their cultures torn apart. We did that as a nation. And what has happened with federal recognition of the tribes is at least some sense that that happened, that this was a war of conquest and not a war of assimilation. And all the Indian tribes in Virginia are asking is for a comparable recognition that the very first tribes that Europeans met deserve the same recognition. And Ken hasn't talked about it, but for me as a Virginian, the sorriest example I can think of our history as a state came in the era between about 1910 and 1935 or 40, when a man named Plecker ran the Bureau of Vital Statistics and in effect undertook through the use of paper to wipe out any trace of Indian people in Virginia. You could not put on a birth certificate that you were an Indian. So the tribes who, as Ken has said, have tried to keep themselves together in the face of terrible health issues, in the face of terrible economic issues, in the face of having no political representation, we're now being faced with being eliminated on paper as not even being here. And as Virginians, if that doesn't make you angry, then you've got something wrong with your moral compass. And part of what we're trying to do is get that moral compass pointed in the right direction. And that's what Ken is speaking about, and that's what this whole, in my mind, this whole issue is about. There, I've taken advantage of my position.
That's quite all right.
If any of you would want to ask some questions, that lady back there. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I wanted to list the tribes in Virginia and where it was.
I can do that. In King William County, the county which I reside in, there are three tribes. There's the Pamunkey, the Mattapani, and the Upper Mattapani. Pamunkey. In New Kent County, there's the Eastern Chickahominy. In Charles City County, there are the Chickahominy. In Suffolk area, there are the Nansemonds. In King and Queen and Essex County, there are the Rappahannocks. And in Amherst County, there are the Monacans.
Which are the two that aren't trying to get
the two on the reservations?
They are which?
And one of those is trying to go through that long, long, drawn-out administrative process. Yes. Oh, well, you're the moderator.
No, you go.
When you achieve federal recognition, will the current two state reservations then become federal reservations?
No, because they're not on the bill. Their names are not on the bill.
Just the tribes will get recognized.
Just the ones that are on the bill, the six that have chosen.
The two on the reservations are not part of this legislative effort.
I see.
Yes. Okay, I'll get this gentleman, and I'll come right back to you, and then to you, sir. Okay.
I want to spend a little time on the Holy Reservation, since I have a friend who was connected to the education system there, and also he supported some of that thought, and including the snake dance on the Holy Reservation. And I did want to know a little bit from you about why the Holy Reservation is surrounded by the Navajo Reservation. But my main question is, why is it we do not go through a national Indian council, or whatever you want to call it, because the divide and conquer method has been a method in which the government and other bodies have sought to separate weakened people.
Yes.
So I'm just asking, why is it that it's not like the Navajo Reservation, Indian Reservation, and other reservations that are well established and do have some power, and to some extent some wealth, although the Holy Reservation is very poor, why is it you do not have that one single voice? Because what has happened in Africa, I may say, is the same people that you've been talking about dividing up this Indian reservation on this country, also divided up Africa, and therefore they've been weak, and they've been powerless, or less powerful. So I'm trying to see now, can you see why you might not be going through a national Indian group force to accomplish a mission.
Okay, I can answer part of that, and I don't know why that Hopi reservation is surrounded by the Navajo. I don't have a clue. But you know how the government bureaucracy works. So, anyway, but there is a national organization called the National Congress of American Indians, which does work on these issues. The problem is the NCAI is a 501c3 nonprofit, so it can only do so much as far as lobbying Congress. I think 10% of its funds can be used to lobby or something to that effect. So it is a nonprofit. That's the only national organization. Now, let's just delve into that one little bit more. Until about 120 years ago or so, even the tribes that didn't fall under the reign of the United States considered themselves separate nations. They were separate nations. So in many cases, that holdover is still there. The Navajo are a nation of people, a separate nation. The Hopi are a separate nation of people. And nations, even the folks like the United Nations, don't come together on every single issue. So, but and I know I'm just kind of picking at straws here, but that sort of thing. But that's part of it. It's because they were always separate nations, and it still hasn't filtered itself out of that. That's part of it. That's not all of it, but that's a major part of it. And yes, ma'am.
I will keep wondering. Do you live in a town surrounded by people who are not Indian? And your children go to public schools? What's happening now?
Okay, they all go to public schools now. I mean, that's just the way of life it is right now. The Upper Mattaponi people actually established their own school in the 1880s and asked for federal funds for assistance with the school. And then we finally built one, another physical building in 1919. But the only way that we could get any kind of accreditation from the school system was to turn it over to the county, and then the county provided us a teacher. My mother went to that school in 1920s. I attended the same school, not the same building, but the same school in the 1950s and 60s. So, but since that time, of course, everybody knows that the segregation era, for the most part, ended, so all the schools became integrated. And so Rich has met with us in that school building several times. So we have our own communities. We have our specific communities, yes. And when I attended that particular school, the only people who attended that school were Indian kids. And we all lived right there surrounding the school and the church. We're all right there. Now that's changed a bit. We're more dispersed because people have been seeking better opportunities. When they seek better opportunities, they go elsewhere. So there's a certain amount of dispersion, even though they all come back in the summer when we have our homecoming. There was one other gentleman. He left. But Rich, I'll go with you.
I think they might find it of interest of how the treaties that your tribe and other tribes drew with the state of Virginia before the U.S. existed are now affected by projects that are of current interest, and how that might be used, what the current laws might allow you to do to create a greater sense of Indian identity and heritage in our own state now.
Yeah, I think I can. What Rich is talking about is an issue that's going on in Newport News in King William County. It's concerning a reservoir. Now, the Newport News wants to build a reservoir for water, to support growth in Newport News as that area grows. They'll need more water, so they wanted to build a reservoir, 400-acre reservoir, and pump that water from the reservoir down to Newport News. They want to draw the water to go into the reservoir from the Mattaponi River. Now, there are three tribes that live, and the pipeline is going on the Pamunkey River. Now, in order to establish that reservoir, they're going to be a certain amount of destruction of wetlands. And during that destruction of wetlands, traditional cultural properties, native properties, are going to be destroyed. According to the law, there has to be a certain amount of mitigation with destruction of those properties. So we're in the process of dealing with that reservoir. And when this process first started 10, 15 years ago, we somehow managed, and I still don't know exactly how it happened, we somehow managed to the core in that management of that process, the core of engineers decided that they were going to treat us as if we were federally recognized tribes. Once that statement was made by the Corps of Engineers, then they had to deal with us as if we were federally recognized tribes on that project, on that reservoir project. That is absolutely huge, just by virtue, because if those reservoirs were built and all of those cultural properties were destroyed that go back 10,000 years, we would have no say-so at all unless the Corps had done that. And the Corps did do that. And I don't know why they did it at this point, but thank God they did do it.
Well, may I just say, I think in part because you said a moral compass. I think
maybe that was it.
Looked at it, they saw it through the eyes of other Indian tribes and said, we are not going to treat you differently than the others, right? Because we see the similarities between your tribe and those that we've dealt with.
Right. I'd like to make one more statement on that. That was the Mattaponi tribe went to the Supreme Court of Virginia to see if we could get that fight on the reservoir occurred to federal court. It didn't happen, even though the courts still didn't go to federal court because we're not federally recognized tribes. The court battle did not get elevated to federal court. And during part of that whole deal, and also with the recognition process, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia actually traveled to Washington to talk to the folks that were sponsoring our bills. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia actually traveled to Washington to talk to the people who were sponsoring our bills, and he never even called us at all. Yes, I have to answer this gentleman here. Did I get you already? I'm trying to divvy this up a little bit. Let me get this lady. I'm sorry.
If, as you say, the whole question of casinos is off the table, what possible objections remain to your getting the federal
staff? Well, I think a lot of it is because they want to keep you under their thumb. They don't want us to have a decision-making process where we can decide our own destiny. I believe that's part of it.
Is it possibly also that if they say yes to you, they have to say yes to other requests?
No, they don't have to say that. Each bill stands on its own virtues.
Yes.
I was wondering, I think this question is for Mr. Lee. Do you have Jim Webb's email address? I think I have yours and John Warner's.
Well,
what is the name of the committee?
All right, the question has come up. Is there a Senate bill number been assigned to this?
No, it hasn't.
No, it has not.
The House bill is HB 1294. The House bill is HB 1294, and Webb has asked Dorgan to use that same bill.
Okay, so you can, when you write your letter, you can say the Senate companion bill to HB
1294.
Senate companion bill? And do you have an email address for...
Doesn't it sound like John Warner is the one we need?
Both need to be.
Both need to
be. Yeah.
You need to contact Warner and Dorgan and Webb, the three of them.
Warner and Webb are our senators, and if our two senators are behind this, it'll happen.
May I suggest that you just put this on the internet, that is, where people can get raptured from that internet and say, write this place.
That's a good point. We have an internet. We have a website. It's VITALVA. V, Victor. V I.
Vital.
Vital.
VITALVA.
So do you have this particular information we talk about right now?
Yeah. Yes. We have a lot of that information on the site. And I think it's .org. I think it's .org. VITALVA.org. I think it's .org, or it may be .com, but I think it's .org.
Please write a letter.
Indian Affairs Committee. Senate Indian Affairs.
Dorgan,
Senator.
Write a letter. But
the letter doesn't arrive for months.
Well, you can fax it. If you decide to fax a letter, that it gets there right away.
You can send the letter.
But it will get there.
You can send their letters to their state offices.
Mm-hmm. That's
Jim
true.
Webb has one in Richmond, and so does Warden. And that doesn't go through the whole anthrax
scheme. I was given to understand that they don't have to open letters for hundreds of years if they don't want to, but they must reply to emails. And I always get a reply to an email saying,
well,
I got your email.
Well, you just get a reply saying you got it.
It's auto. Yeah, but it means that they've read it.
No.
No.
This is not an issue. They can't tell by the envelope what you're writing about.
I don't know the fax number, but I think you can go to the Webbs and Dorgan's and Warner's office and find their fax number. I fax letters to them myself, but it goes there. It's immediately.
Yeah. Or you can call.
Yeah, you can
just
call.
Pick up the phone and call and say, we want Senator Warner to co-sponsor a bill that's companion to HB 1294. That's all. HB 1294. House Bill 1294. That's a bill that's already been passed for recognition. That's done. HB 1294. Ma'am?
We want them to support that bill.
Well, we want them to support the Senate version of that bill. And as Ken says, they hope it will be named, it will also be Senate Bill 1294. Makes it easier to track if they both have the same numbers. But that's, there are any number of ways to contact, and I would expect people in this room a little bit more sophisticated about contacting your elected representatives than the average person. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to help you. All right.
Thank you.
If you haven't contributed, it's time. Oh, Nancy.